Our guest tonight is Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers, and we are having a wonderful discourse. And LA Control is working on the signal down there. They have found no issues whatsoever. I continue to get little things from Memphis Station. Emailer says this is the first time to his knowledge that this station has ever gone off the air during a coast program. These numerous dropout events emphasize the importance of this particular program, which is a really good reason. I know you think I'm trying to sell you something here, but I'm not. I'm trying to give you an idea on a good tool. This is the only place you're going to hear this kind of programming. It really is. Free into your radio. But if it doesn't come into your radio and you miss something, then for a very, very small amount of money, you can ensure that you have 3 years of archive shows. You can go back and share them with people. And while we're at it, might I mention that you might suggest to your friends that they tune into some of these programs, because it might become very important to them later, if you get my drift. John B. Wells in with you tonight. It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. And we will return with Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stuart Rhodes, we'll go anywhere that you want to go with this. Somebody just asked, say, is there anything that we can do? Is there any legislation we could enact at the state level to hold our own state representatives accountable for their votes other than voting them out? Example, holding John McCain accountable for co-authoring the NDAA by trying him at the state level?
Well, I think that should be tried, and in fact, it kind of fits in with what I believe is a constitutional remedy, which is the states have to stand up. And the model for this to look at is with what Jefferson and Madison both did in response to the Alien Sedition Acts, which were a gross violation of the Bill of Rights in their day. In 1798, the Alien Sedition Acts was passed, and it allowed them, among other things, to arrest people for their speech. You had newspaper editors who were put in prison and writers put in prison. And Jefferson and Madison, in their response, it's very instructive. They did two things at the same time. One, they went to the state legislatures and said, you have an obligation and a duty to stand up and defend the Constitution and defend the people and the rights of the people against unjust power. You have an obligation to first declare that this law passed by Congress is null and void from inception, that nowhere does Congress have this power, and in fact, it's in direct violation of a very clear mandates of the First Amendment. So, and you also have an obligation to step in between and protect your people against this unjust law, this law that has no validity whatsoever under the Constitution. And so, this is an important point: is they didn't go to the federal courts. They didn't wait for the Supreme Court to rule it unconstitutional. And in fact, they knew that was very unlikely, because the courts at that time were packed with Federalists. This was the Federalist Party that controlled the Congress and White House and the courts at that time. Much like today, we should not look to the federal courts for our aid in this situation. They are not going to save us. They've, in fact, themselves rubber-stamped this claimed power of the president. In 2004, in a case called Hamdi, the Supreme Court, using an old World War II case, we could talk about some more if you want, but they did as they said, yes, this is a power that the president does have. Nothing in the Constitution prevents the U.S. government from designating one of its own citizens as unlawful combatant. Well, that's clearly not true. The Treason Clause is very clear, as I already said, and Scalia, in his dissent in that case, pointed out to the Treason Clause, what are you guys doing? You know, this is very, very clear right here in Article 3 what must be done with this person. And so he dissented. It was joined by Stevens. But the point is that was the dissent. The majority went along with this idea that the president can strip you of your protections under the Bill of Rights. And they said, well, you'll get a right to at least a habeas review. You get a right to challenge your detention, a right to challenge your designation. But you're not going to get a grand jury indictment. You're not going to get a jury trial. At most, you'll get a review by a judge. And they said even a military tribunal could satisfy that requirement for a review of whether or not your detention was lawful. And so they threw the Bill of Rights out the window, and they constructed some new system, which had never before existed in our history. And as Scalia said in his dissent, the court was playing Mr. Fix-It. But going back to what we can do, if you look back at what Jefferson and Madison did, is they didn't go to the courts and ask for help, because they knew the courts were packed with Federalists. They went to the state legislature and said, you have a duty and obligation under your reserved powers as states, the dual sovereignty system, you know, not, the power is not given or reserved to the states, and you have a duty to defend that division of power, and you have a duty to defend your people against violations of their rights. And at the same time, they also swept the oath breakers out of office. They started a whole new political party, and Jefferson, you know, swept into the White House, and the Jeffersonians took over Congress and kicked out all the Federalists. And the only place the Federalists were left after that was in the courts. That's where you had Marshall, and who sat there forever almost on the Supreme Court, ruling, you know, to expand the government's powers. But other than that, they rolled back the assault on the Bill of Rights, which came just, you know, the ink was barely dry on the Constitution and on the Bill of Rights before this assault came, and they rolled it back. And now you look back at it, it's called the Revolution of 1800. If it was a peaceful revolution using those twin tactics of sweeping the bums out in politics, but also using nullification in the states. And they authored the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which made it very clear the duty and responsibilities of the states. So I encourage folks to go read, in particular Jefferson's, which he wrote the Kentucky resolutions. Go read those, and those show you a very clear way to handle this. And I think it's absolutely imperative that as individuals, as churches, as towns, as counties, as states, county sheriffs, police departments, as individual police officers, they all must nullify. They all must say this is null and void from inception, and we will not participate, we will not aid it, and further, we will interpose ourselves and defend our people. And I've just been working with Richard Fry, who's the general counsel for Patriot Coalition, and also the founder, Jeff Lewis, of Patriot Coalition. We spent a week together in Kansas writing up model bills, and one of them is about to be introduced by the legislature of Oklahoma. We have a legislator in Oklahoma who's going to introduce it. We have other ones that are for sheriffs, and so we're going to encourage, you know, at every level of government. And we have a Colorado county has already passed a resolution against the NDAA. But bringing that back around to your question, yes, that would include a sheriff stepping in between and defending his people physically against this abuse. And it would be wonderful if he also had the backup of the state legislature with a law that made it a crime to grab somebody. It's basically kidnapping. But made it a crime for anybody, meaning whatever their title is, to come and take an American away to be detained in military detention or to be subjected to a military trial, unless there's somebody already in the military. Like when I served as a paratrooper, I was under the UCMJ. That's constitutional. Coming and grabbing me or anybody else and treating us as though we were some guy in Afghanistan is not constitutional, and we need to step up and stand up against it. And yes, even in the face of the Supreme Court, even if the Supreme Court goes along with this, as I suspect they will, we need to say, you know, just because you say something, that's not the Constitution. I mean, the Supreme Court judges, when they take their office, are required to swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Well, why would that be if the Constitution is merely whatever the judges say it is? If that were the case, they would just take an oath to say, I swear to obey and defend whatever I say. You know, it's an absurdity. So there is a limit to the deference we should give the courts. The courts have been wrong in the past. They were wrong in Dred Scott. They were wrong in Plessy versus Ferguson, where they said that, you know, it's separate but equal is okay under the Constitution. Blacks can be forced to drive at the back of the bus or the back of the train. They were wrong in that. They were wrong in World War I and in the Schenck case, where they said that, you know, it was a guy passing out anti-war leaflets, and the court ruled that his arrest was constitutional, because and Justice Holmes, what he said in the decision is whatever peace might be tolerated in peacetime will not be tolerated so long as men fight. But where's that exception in the Constitution? That's not what the First Amendment says. But yet they did it. So they were wrong in there. And they were wrong in Korematsu in World War II, where they said that it was constitutional somehow for them to, you know, use mass internment against American citizens just because of their race, because they were of Japanese descent. That was wrong. And the case they're relying on for this power, this claimed authority, is from World War II also, 1942. It's called Ex Parte Querin. And that is the first time in our history the court has found, quote-unquote, constitutional this claim that Americans can be treated like a foreign enemy in wartime. And that's the case where you had 8 German saboteurs come ashore to blow up factories and commit other acts of sabotage. And one of them claimed to be a U.S. citizen. And FDR, the president, said, I don't care. I'm going to try him by military tribunal also. And he appealed and said, I get a trial as an American. You must try me for treason in a civilian jury, before a civilian jury. And the court in that case, the same court, the same New Deal court that had given FDR everything else he wanted when it came to the Commerce Clause powers, when it came to other war power trials like Korematsu, all of those, the same court said, okay, we're going to give the president what he wants, and we're going to go find a way. And the way they found was to say, well, what counts is what you're charged with, not who you are. You know, back in 1866, the Supreme Court had said, what counts is who you are. It doesn't matter what you're charged with. It doesn't make a difference what you're charging him with. But the court in 1942 reversed that and said, oh, no, what counts is what you're charged with. So if you're charged with violations of laws of war, it's a military tribunal that has jurisdiction over those charges. Even though what this man was accused of doing was being a traitor. He's an American citizen accused of making war against his own country. And going back to the treason clause, that is the very definition of treason. And Article 3, the treason clause, makes it very plain, along with Article 2, Article 3, Section 2, that you try somebody like that for a trial for treason in a civilian jury before a jury of his peers. But the Supreme Court totally ignored the treason clause, ignored the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, ignored our own history, where denial of jury trial was one of the causes of our own revolution. They ignored all of that to give FDR what he wanted. And that is the case that is laid around like a loaded gun since 1942, almost forgotten until 2001, when the Bush administration saw that, reached back and grabbed that old precedent and said, we can use this to do whatever we want in the war on terror against anybody, including American citizens. And that's been the precedent that they have used ever since. And that's what the Supreme Court in 2004 affirmed and said, yes, under this old case, Ex parte Quirin, we recognize that what counts is what you're charged with. And so this is where we are. So really the seeds of our destruction were sown in 1942. And only since 9/11 have they been, you know, brought to fruition. And here we are, with Congress giving its full assent. And that matters, because before this, it was an inference, it was an interpretation from the 2001 authorization for use of military force that was passed by Congress a month after, or mere weeks after 9/11. So it's that 2001 authorization for the use of military force that has been looked at as giving congressional authority to use it on American citizens, use detention and trial. But what Congress has now done is gone and said, yes, that's what we meant. They're pretending in the NDAA that they're merely affirming that they had already given all of this permission to do all of these things back in 2001. Even though in 2001 the statute said nothing about military trial, nothing about interning somebody for the duration of the conflict, none of that stuff. All it said is the president is authorized to use military force against any nation, organization, or persons that he, this is a key word, that he determines were involved in 9/11 or aided those who were. And that was used by the Bush administration to justify the detention of two U.S. citizens, Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, and to also justify the NSA spying on Americans. The claim there was that, well, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply here. This is about warfare. The president as commander-in-chief has the power to surveil the battlefield. That was the argument that in defense of the NSA spying on Americans without warrants. And that's an important point for people to understand, is that under this logic, the Bill of Rights only applies if they are using it for criminal prosecutions or criminal investigations, or they're accusing you of a crime. But once they say it's warfare, the Bill of Rights is thrown in the trash can, and he can surveil the battlefield in violation of the Fourth Amendment without warrant. He can kill you on sight if he wants to, as Obama has begun to do, or he can intern you for the duration of the conflict, or he can have you tried by a military tribunal. And this is exactly the same thing that Lincoln had done in the Civil War that the Supreme Court had ruled unconstitutional. It's the same exact thing happening all over again. But unfortunately, the modern court has embraced this. And when I was at Yale, the most shocking experience I had was to be, it was like a Twilight Zone episode. I was the only person in my entire procedure class who said this is unconstitutional and this is wrong. Both the liberals and the conservative students and the liberal professors and the conservative professors all agreed that it's totally fine to treat an American citizen or lawful resident exactly the same as a foreign enemy in wartime. They were fine with it. The only way I could change their minds, the liberal professor I was working with, the only way I could convince him this is wrong is when I showed him that it was being used to facilitate torture. Only when he saw that the extraordinary rendition that was being done to people, sending them off to Egypt or Syria, places like that, that it was being used so that they could be tortured. Only then did he change his mind about it and start to oppose it. So he didn't oppose it on constitutionalist grounds. He opposed it because he didn't like the outcome. And that's the modern American disease. And that's why you have people who are asleep at the switch, not paying attention, you know, and drinking the Kool-Aid whenever their guy's in power. They are not paying attention to structure, and they're trusting the goodness of the person in power. And that's not the system we have. The founders were adamant that we do not trust that good men will always be at the helm. And as Jefferson said in the Kentucky Resolution, let's hear no more of trust in men, but bind them down with the chains of the Constitution. Because that was the argument being used back then. Well, John Adams, President John Adams, is a good man. He won't abuse his power. And Jefferson, that's what Jefferson said in response to that. Let's hear no more of trust in men. That's the whole point of a written Constitution. And that's the whole point of the Bill of Rights, is it's the structure. Because a good analogy for this situation, you know, sometimes people say, well, I'm not worried about this. I'm not Al-Qaeda. I'm not the Taliban. So I'm not worried about being wrongfully accused of this. Well, the word accused implies that you're going to get a trial. This is not an accusation against you. The president simply determines you are an unlawful belligerent. Once he gives you that label, that's it. There's no trial. They just detain you for the duration of the conflict. But one way to look at this is like this. It's like there are laws against murder, but you and I both feel pretty safe against those laws being used against us. Not just because we're not murderers. What really keeps us safe is the fact that before they can take away our life or our liberty for the crime of murder, they must do what? They must indict us for a grand jury, and then they must try us before a jury of our peers. We get a trial. Get a chance to confront our accusers, present evidence on our behalf. They must prove beyond reasonable doubt to a jury of our fellow citizens that we are guilty. That's what keeps us safe, not the fact that we're not murderers. Because every oppressive regime throughout time has always used a bad label against you. They always say you're a terrorist, you're a murderer, they always accuse you, you're a traitor. Those are the labels they're going to use. And so it's not enough to say, well, you know, I'm safe because I'm not part of Al-Qaeda. You know, they will expand this power out. They will, it'll be used beyond the original intent, and it will be used against political opponents and political dissidents. And that goes back to DHS demonizing returning veterans, demonizing constitutionalists. The word constitutionalist is, in DHS's eyes, equal to the word terrorist. And that's what they want the public to think also. And when you have, you know, the CEO of Southern Poverty Law Center sitting on that panel, helping to write the training manuals and helping to guide the instruction that local police and in federal police also get, when you have that happening, you can see where that demonization program is one small step away from merging with this second track of minimal or non-existent due process that they're creating under the auspices of the laws of war. They're putting the pieces together and all the infrastructure. They haven't used it yet to its full effect, but we should not wait for its full effect. We shouldn't wait until we have mass internments like in Germany or in Soviet Russia. We should oppose it on principle now. That's what our founders did. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of Americans denied jury trial, but it was enough that they opposed the principle. They said, look, you cannot claim an authority over us not granted in our Constitution. And that's one of the terms of the king, that he has attempted to subject us, combined with others, to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. And one other thing they said about him is he...
Hold on. Hold that thought right there, Stuart. You got to hold your thought because we got to come back. We've got to take a hard break. And we'll do it now and come back with Stuart Rhodes on Coast to Coast AM. The Enemy Expatriation Act, H.R. 3166, was introduced by Republican Representative Charles Dent of Pennsylvania. According to the People's Voice, the Enemy Expatriation Act is a short yet dangerous bill. The purpose of the bill is to add engaging in or supporting hostilities against the United States to the list of acts for which United States nationals would lose their nationality, you see. President Barack Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law despite public approval ratings as low as 2%. 2%. Whether American citizens who are guaranteed due process of law by their Bill of Rights were included in the authority of the NDAA was not made absolutely clear, but the independent press fears that if the Enemy Expatriation Act passes, the confusing language of the NDAA would be a moot point, because if Americans can easily be stripped of their citizenship rights, they would then fall under the NDAA. People, this is really happening. And it's time for everybody to cowboy and cowgirl up and do something about it. We'll be back with Stuart Rhodes right after this. This is Coast to Coast. John B. in with you tonight on the bridge of the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. And our guest tonight is Stuart Rhodes. And this is all very disturbing. I bet I know what your take is on the Enemy Expatriation Act, H.R. 3166. But maybe you'd like to amplify a little bit on it. Talk to us about that for a minute.
Well, that's yet another way. Just like in the founders era, there were multiple statutes that the parliament had passed. One of them was to allow them to be taken across the seas for trial for treason in England. But another method, as we already talked about, was expanding jurisdiction of the admiralty courts. And yet another method was to strip them of their right to jury trial in certain cases. This is kind of like that. This is yet another way to get around the Bill of Rights. So it's kind of like a Chinese menu. Once this is in place, they can, depending upon the political expediency and which one's better for them politically, they can either go ahead and detain you even though you're a U.S. citizen, as has already been done to U.S. citizens, or they can just strip you of your citizenship. This gives them many multiple options. I was listening to you on the break. The NDAA, Section 1021 of the NDAA, most assuredly does apply to U.S. citizens. Absolutely. There's no doubt at all about that. It's only the doubt that's being put out about this is by those who signed it, those who voted for it, are trying to defend it and say that somehow it does not apply to U.S. citizens, or they're saying that nothing's changed. It's quite a bit of sleight of hand, and one of the major ways that they're doing the sleight of hand is what they're saying in this is that they affirm, Congress affirms, it says, that the authority of the president to use all necessary and appropriate force pursuant to the authorization for use of military force, that's the one from 2001, includes the authority for the armed forces of the United States to detain covered persons as defined in subsection B, pending disposition under the laws of war. And then they go in and they define what a covered person is, and then they lay out what can be done to them. But the point is that they're claiming that all they're doing is affirming the powers they already granted back in 2001. And even though back in 2001, in writing, they only talked about military force, did not talk about any of the rest of it, they're claiming that they're merely affirming that that authorization contained all these powers already. So, and then among the things that can be done to you, it says here, disposition under the law of war. The disposition of a person under the law of war as described in subsection A may include the following. 1. Detention under the law of war without trial until the end of the hostilities authorized by the authorization for use of military force. 2. Trial under Chapter 47A of Title 10, United States Code, as amended by the Military Commissions Act of 2009. So what that means is trial by military commission. Or 3, transfer for trial by an alternative court or competent tribunal having lawful jurisdiction. And 4, transfer to the custody or control of the person's country of origin, any other foreign country, or any other foreign entity. And this is what's new. For the first time in writing, Congress is adding to the use of force. They're adding on detention, military trial, and also extraordinary rendition. And that is new. Now, the reason why I know this applies to U.S. citizens is because this is supposedly merely affirming what they already granted in 2001. Well, that authorization for use of military force in 2001 was used by the Bush administration to detain two U.S. citizens, and that was ruled by the Supreme Court to be constitutional. And in the Hamdi case in 2004, the Supreme Court explicitly said that Congress had authorized detention of U.S. citizens when it authorized in 2001 the president to use military force. So it's already been interpreted. The law that this is simply, you know, fleshing out and clarifying has already been interpreted to apply to U.S. citizens, has already been interpreted to allow for their detention, and has already been used for those purposes. And so that's why it's very plain and clear, you know. But of course, adding to that, you can look at the text of the law itself. It says any person the president determines had anything to do with 9/11, or, and this is the new stuff they added on, a person who was a part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces. When lawyers write words, they do so very carefully. When they say any person, they mean any person. It doesn't say any person who's not a U.S. citizen. It doesn't say any person except U.S. citizens. It says any person. So this does apply to any person the president wants to put this label upon. It's already been defended as applying to U.S. citizens, and that view has already won out in federal courts. And so people need to set aside any hope that this law somehow does not apply to U.S. citizens. It does. You need to accept that and deal with it. And the Expatriation Act is just the next shoe to drop to make it easier for them to circumvent the Bill of Rights. Like I said, it'll depend upon political. All we have now, as far as the courts are concerned, and with this whole, with every branch of the federal government now in lockstep joint violation of the Bill of Rights, all we really have now are political checks. What can they get away with politically? And so that's why they want to have the ability to strip you of your citizenship. Just one more tool that they can use against you.
This is unbelievable to me. You know, it is said that a person's affinity for firearms is only one mugging away. And I would add to that that your revolutionary spirit, I'm talking to every person who is hearing this broadcast, left, right, black, white, green, purple, melon-colored, brown, your revolutionary patriot self is just one dragging of one of your family members into a van with a black bag over their head for rendition, interrogation, no lawyer, no phone call, no nothing away. And I can't help but throw that in there because I got to tell you something, Stuart. I'm not just concerned. I'm getting mad.
Good. That's what it's going to take. I mean, and when I talked to this lady who had survived Nazi Germany, she agreed with me that we're about 1934 Germany. That's about where we are. That's what she said. And so that's our choice. We're either going to be, is it 1934 Germany, which slid into a horrible dictatorship, or is it 1774 America? That's our choice.
It really is. Now, let me ask you, your organization, Oath Keepers, that's made up of active, reserve, and retired military and police?
That's
retired. Does retired enter into it, or is it just active and reserve?
Oh, retired and veterans also. So, like, I'm a disabled veteran, so a lot of us are veterans, but quite a few of us are also current serving. And we have a wonderful, on our Oath Keepers website at oathkeepers.org right now, we have a wonderful letter that was written by one of our Ohio active duty police officers, who's also a state leader for Oath Keepers in Ohio. And it's his draft, his letter to his fellow police officers and sheriffs. And one thing I'll quote from here is he says, "I believe that if and when those orders come, I cannot in good faith and in strict observance to my oath allow myself to be a part of them. I would hope that members of our military, in accordance with the articles of the UCMJ, would also refuse them as well. When that time comes, I will do exactly as I have sworn to do. I will serve and protect those under my care. So help me God." And so this is from one of our police officers in Ohio, and he's spreading that around and encouraging other officers to say the same thing. And the sheriff's resolution we just drafted will say the same thing. And this weekend is going to be the Constitutional Sheriff Convention here in Las Vegas, where I'm at right now, with Sheriff Mack leading the way. About 100 sheriffs are gathering together, and I'm going to address them and talk to them about the NDAA and encourage them and urge them to adopt a resolution as individual sheriffs that they will stand up and defend their people against this. This is what we have to do. And if the military, this is the whole point of Oath Keepers, if the military will nullify against this, if we can get a mass nullification refusal to do this, then we will have the time to fix this politically and fix it through our states. If they obey these orders and, you know, God forbid, begin to black bag Americans here inside the United States, then there will be Americans who will fight back. We will not wait. We will not be like Solzhenitsyn in the Soviet Union, where Solzhenitsyn says, you know, how we burned in the camps later, wondering what if we had fought back. And they lamented the fact that they had not fought back when they came for them. Instead, they all, you know, cowered in terror, waiting for the knock at the door. He said, if only they'd have known the full situation and known that they had nothing to lose, they could have ambushed them. They could have ambushed the organs of the state, the blue caps, they called them, and with anything at hand, axes, pokers, knives, whatever. And eventually, if they'd have done that, if they'd have fought back, then Stalin, despite all of Stalin's thirst, the machine would have ground to a halt, is what Solzhenitsyn said. Here's a famous dissident in the Soviet Union who lived in the gulags for like 15, 20 years and saw many of his friends freeze to death. And so he said, hey, we waited too late. They waited too late. And so, but that won't happen in America. And I know people are very cynical a lot of times and think that Americans are now sheep. But there are still plenty of people out there who still have that fire, that courage, like their forefathers, who will fight. And so I don't want to see that happen, though. I do not want to see veterans fighting against current serving. I don't want to see that.
No, nobody wants to see it. It would be tragic if that happened. And, you know, nobody who's talking, who's taking, I'm going to say, our position, because I share yours wholeheartedly. This isn't, I'm not looking for an excuse to engage anybody. I'm just like the average guy that just wants to live as long. Well, I'm not going to say that because I've always been a little bit on the radical side. A little bit, because you know I've got a good BS detector and it works. It's reliable, and my cynicism toward the government goes all the way back to the Kennedy assassination when I was old enough to be cognizant that this is awfully pat the way this thing went down. What do you think I am, an imbecile? I mean, that was about like listening to Marilyn Monroe sing Happy Birthday to President Kennedy. It's like, oh boy, those two have got something going on. I think I was in the fifth grade when that happened. But this is ugly, and I think a lot of people. I would ask anybody who wants to flee from this information not to. Do not shrink. You're needed, every last one of you. Everybody within the range of this broadcast is needed. You cannot leave this to someone else. Solzhenitsyn is the you're talking about the Gulag Archipelago when he wrote, nobody said, they're arresting me. They're arresting me for nothing. They're taking me away. For God's sake, somebody help me. No, nobody said anything. They just went quietly. And by the time it was all over, what was it? One in three people was KGB, either an informant or an officer. It was horrible. These things really happened. And they will happen again because a good chair does not make us more fit. It makes us soft, and before long, we're not comfortable sitting. Now we want to lie down, and many of us are choosing to lie down, and this is just not the time. You can pick it up from there, and anytime you want, I'll be happy to shut up now, and you just go ahead, Stuart.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, this is the critical moment for us. I mean, this is where we have to choose. And like I gave a speech last night here in Las Vegas on the NDAA, and I said, look, that's the choice. The hypothetical choice is between 1934 Germany and 1774 America. But I said, look, you're not going to have that choice because we won't let you. And my point is that those of us who are veterans, and I don't just mean within Oath Keepers, there's 25 million veterans in this country, and more of them waking up every day. And my message was to the current serving that you're not going to have the option of just going down 1934 Germany path. We won't let you. We will make it into the 1774 America if we have to. But we don't want to do that. But no one's going to remain free unless they're willing to fight for it. And certainly it should be the last option. But you can't say that we will never fight, that violence is never a solution, because our forefathers had to. We may have to as well. But what will save us from having to do that, this was the message to the current serving, is that if you, the current serving out there, will simply do what's right and obey the Constitution, then you will not compel us to have to fight. You can stop this. It's still in your hands. Even though the courts are against us, even though the Congress is against us, even though the President is against us, all three branches of the federal government have committed treason against the Constitution, even though that's the fact, you can still stop it from going any further by simply doing what's right and refusing to do this to your own people. Buy us the time to do our modern version of what Jefferson and Madison did, to sweep them all out of office, all the oath breakers, to the political process, and buy us time to strengthen our states and have our states stand up and defend the people. Those two things have to be done at the same time. But they will only happen, we'll only have time to do that if the military will refuse these orders. Because as soon as they start blackbagging veterans, I can guarantee you that other veterans are not going to just sit there waiting for the knock at the door. They're going to figure they have nothing left to lose but to fight, and they're going to go out there and go for the bad guys. That's how they see it. And I've talked to veterans across the country that have told me this, that I'm not going to wait. They're not going to be like Solzhenitsyn and the other men who lamented the fact that they did not fight back. So to avoid that, simply follow the Constitution. Every police officer out there, every military person out there listening to this, do your duty under the Constitution. If you're willing to go fight and die, and I know you are. You're willing. You have the courage. If you're willing to fight and die against a foreign foe to defend your country, then you should have the same courage and dedication to putting yourself at risk, even if you're going to face a court martial, or even in the worst case, you know, execution. Be willing to do the same when it comes to defending the Constitution here at home. And the first thing is, don't be a tool of oppression over your own people. Do not. You know, and God forbid, if we did take off in another revolution, then they'll have to choose sides also. Whose side are they going to fight on? You know, are they going to be traitors to the Constitution? Are they going to fight on the side of the rights of the people? But to stop from getting there, hopefully we can just put the brakes on right now. And that's what the states have to stand up. That's what everyone, you know, mass civil disobedience, even in our churches, too. That's why I'm proud to be a member of Chuck Baldwin's church there in Kalispell, Montana. I go to his sermons whenever I'm in town, we go. We live in the same town, but he has a powerful message for the churches out there, which is don't be obedient. Don't buy the nonsense that Romans 13 makes you mandates that you must be subservient to whoever happens to hold political power. He has a really great book he just wrote with his son, Tim, about Romans 13. I encourage folks to go check it out. But every level, and every, you know, whether it's a veterans hall, whether it's a church, whether it's a community group, they all have to get together and say, we will stand and defend each other against this. And we will support our sheriff. We'll form a posse. All the veterans in the county should form a posse in support of their sheriff and say, Sheriff, we will be here under your command when you need us.
Excellent. I would like to remind the listening audience, there's nothing political about this. Because if this isn't paranormal behavior on behalf of our elected officials, then I really don't know what paranormal is. And maybe never will. John B. Wells in with you tonight. Our guest is Stuart Rhodes, and we will return on Coast to Coast AM.